Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A new study from the Pew Research Center's Economic Mobility Project looked at parents and their children and found that 83% of children earned at least $1,000 more than their parents. But it doesn't necessarily mean that those children are more socially mobile. We'll talk about social mobility and incomes and dual-income families, which figure prominently in this story. Gregory Clark is our guest this hour, professor of economics at the University of California, Davis. He has an interesting background. He is originally, I believe, from Ireland, and then he lived in Scotland for a good part of his life, and then he was educated in the United States, so he's really been all over the world, and thus can also give us a worldwide perspective on the whole issue of social mobility, and if there are countries in the world that are more socially mobile than the United States and what that means and whether or not it's a good thing. Is it an important thing? What does it say about our economy? Professor Gregory Clark, we thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Tell us about you were born in Ireland, but then you grew up in...
No, that's slightly incorrect. All of my ancestors were born in Ireland.
I see.
So both my grandfathers were, and some of my uncles. But I grew up in the west of Scotland, in the kind of Catholic Irish community there. And then I was educated first as an undergraduate in Cambridge in England, and then I got to see the east coast of the United States, and now I live in California.
You've been all over the place.
Oh, I know.
You are a mobile person.
And I study kind of world economic history, so I really do get to see lots of different societies. I've actually spent some time, for example, in India, studying economic growth in India.
And when you look at your life, Professor Clark, your ancestors worked in coal, didn't they, in coal mining?
Yeah, my grandfather, one of them briefly for a year worked on the mine, but he was saving up to become a small businessman.
Oh.
And then because he had 12 children, he was able to actually staff most of his small enterprise of small stores, actually using his own family labor.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, you've had quite a life. All right, tell me what this study means, that 83%, break this down for us, of children earning at least $1,000 more than their parents.
I'm afraid I don't think it means very much. Over the 30 years of the difference between generations, on average, and over that time period in the United States, there's been almost double the amount of output per person. And so the fact that 83% of people earn somewhat more than their parents doesn't imply that there's been tremendous social mobility in the United States in this period, because what people care about more than their absolute earnings is how are they doing relative to other people in the society. And we know that in this interval in the United States, there's been growing inequality, and that people at the bottom are in absolute are in relative terms doing less well than before. And so that's why I say the Pew study is a little, to my mind, a little to the side of what the things people really care about are.
And when you say output per person, what do you mean?
Oh, and the amount of income that is produced per person in the society. And so as I say, it all depends on what your standard is. Yes, compared to their parents, people are better off, but if you take the top 1% of the society compared to their parents, they're enormously better off. And so, as I say, people, I think what they care about is as much their relative position in the society, how are they doing relative to the average or to the top of the society, as opposed to looking back to their parents' generation.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in any society, we look back far enough. Everyone's going to seem like they're doing tremendously well.
Right, I'm sure. And
I think actually reflects to some degree the recent pessimism about inequality and mobility in the society, that people were thinking about this as good news.
Mm.
Because it really is kind of a minimal type of good news. This, given, as I say, the general economic growth that's gone on.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we need to factor in all of this is that there's been such a dramatic change in terms of two people working in families now, and in probably a good percentage of their parents' generations, that wasn't the case. Two people working full-time, that is. That's a huge change in our society, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, so it turns out it's very arbitrary how we count family incomes, because if you look after your own children, then that's not counted as an income source. But if you look after someone else's children in daycares, then it is counted as income. And so any change in terms of how much people work in the home or outside the home then shows up as differences in these income measures. And so what that would actually say is that to some degree these numbers are optimistic because they're counting now much more the labor of women. It's monetized much more in the modern economy. It wasn't before, but it was still the case that women were doing all kinds of economic activities. It just wasn't counted
right
as part of family income. And so in that sense, the figures are over-optimistic. But other things that they're not counting, though, are there have been significant gains that people have received in terms of health care provision by employees. And health care now is something like 17% of expenditure in the economy. And so though, on the other side of the study, the actual take-home wages may not look that good, but if you look at all of the additional benefits that people are getting from employment, also in the form of pension benefits, these are significant and have significantly improved for many people.
Mm-hmm. And break this down, if you would, among those who make a whole lot, those who make middling amounts of money, and those who are not making very much money. When you look at those who are not college educated in America, I would imagine that there's not a significant change between what children are making compared to what their parents made.
Well, I see that it's a little hard to tell from this study, because what typically happens in any society is that the people at the bottom are tending to move upwards. And so if you compare, you know, someone who is leaving, not completing high school, they're doing very poorly in the modern economy. But most of the people who were not leaving high school a generation ago, a lot of them have children who are completing high school and who are doing somewhat better. And so, as I say, that's why it's a little bit difficult to interpret this kind of study, because there is this mobility that also goes on within the society. And so definitely, you know, if you're comparing the people at the bottom of the society, the outcomes have been pretty poor. Though, as I say, balanced by the fact that, you know, men have done very poorly. Women have done much better, though, and women are much more important contributors to family incomes now. And so that's why, on net, as I say, there's been, even at the bottom of the society, modest gains for families.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be socially mobile? Does it mean that are we looking primarily in terms of money, that you are in the upper class, that you got a couple cars and you got a couple houses, and that makes you in the upper class? And then if you got one car or one and a half and you live in the suburbs that aren't real wealthy, you're middle class. What does the whole thing mean?
Well, it turns out in any society, families are more or less successful, but across a whole variety of measures. And so there's how much education do you get, how much income do you have, how much wealth do you have. Another thing that varies very systematically is how much health and longevity people get.
Oh.
Your health is very predictable from where you are in the social hierarchy. And so it turns out that one of the things is I'm engaged now in completing a book manuscript about social mobility. And one of the things the book argues is that most modern studies of social mobility look at just one aspect, like how much income does a family earn. And that tends to make social mobility seem to be fairly rapid. But if you actually take a much broader measure of the overall status of families, which looks at their education, their income, their wealth, their health, then social mobility is much slower.
Mm-hmm.
And so these individual aspects of families, like your income, your health, your education, they can bounce around a lot. But it turns out when you look at the deeper level of just what's the general kind of social competence of families, that actually seems to be very persistent and to change very slowly. And this study, this book is going to show that if you're an elite family now, your children will still be above the social norm probably 300 years from now.
Oh, my gosh.
That's how persistent status is. And how the book does this, how it's able to look at this over a very long period, is by studying people's social status by looking at surnames. Because in many societies, different surnames have different average degrees of status. And that's very true of the United States, when we've had many different immigrant groups. So there's a whole bunch of surnames in the United States, but if you tell me that surname, I can say, oh, that's a group of above-average status people or below-average status. And then over generation after generation, we can actually track what's happening to the status of those surnames. And if there really was the social mobility that modern studies suggest there should be, then within three or four generations, all surnames would be equivalent in terms of the status.
I see.
But what this study finds is that no, surnames persist as either high or low status. And so, for example, in the United States, one group of surnames that's very high status is Jewish surnames, Ashkenazi Jewish, such as Levine or Katz. And you can predict a lot about what someone's status in life is going to be just knowing that they have the surname Katz. And that's actually telling you that you've got a society of very slow social mobility. The fact that these surnames contain all of this information still three or four generations after the first immigration of the Katz to the United States.
Oh, that's fascinating. And what is the health predictability of wealth? I'm not sure I got all of that.
Oh, and so in any society now, if you are wealthier, you live longer. And that difference can be 6 or 8 years between the poorest groups and the richest groups in society. And it's found, as in most modern societies, this gradient, but it varies across countries. It's much smaller in Sweden than it is in the United States, and it's a reflection of the greater levels of inequality in the United States. But again, looking at surnames, I can predict, or in this study we can predict, that if we know that in Britain a surname had high status in 1800, you can still predict that someone with that surname will live 2 years longer than the average person 200 years later now in 2010 in Britain.
And why is that? Because they're passing money along to generations, so everybody has more money to pay for healthcare?
My interpretation here, and see, this is it's an interesting question, what's driving this, is that families just vary in their kind of general abilities. And what's happening is that those abilities then lead them to making choices that lead to better health, making choices that lead to more wealth, making choices that lead to more education. And it's just a general bundle of abilities that families have. And what is surprising is how strongly that's passed down to children and how difficult it is for any social institution to break that link between successful parents, successful children, or unsuccessful parents and unsuccessful children.
Interesting. And when you look, and I know you have, at societies, you mentioned Sweden, where there is not this huge gap between those who are in the very wealthy class and those who are not, when people who pick up garbage for a living make somewhat the same amount of money as somebody who teaches philosophy for a living. Does that really upset the apple cart here, or what does it do to the whole idea of social mobility?
Well, that was so it was very interesting to look at Sweden, because Sweden is a paradigm of these kind of Scandinavian economies which have very much reduced inequality and which are believed to have very high rates of social mobility. So, for example, it's believed in Sweden, on standard numbers, that only about 10% of the variation in income in the current generation can be explained by looking at people's parents.
Oh.
Right? But 90% of it is just not predictable from the circumstances of their birth. It turns out that Sweden, the rate of social mobility is actually no higher in Sweden than it is in the United States. That there are very persistent elite groups within Swedish society, and one of these groups are the descendants of the Swedish aristocrats. They are still four times more likely to be an attorney than the average person in Sweden. They still earn higher incomes. They still have more wealth. They live in nicer suburbs of Stockholm. And that's people who were made nobles 300 years ago. But they have actually, their modern descendants have no special legal status in Sweden. But if you just know that someone carries one of these noble surnames like von Essen, you know that across all aspects, they will show up as typically above, overrepresented amongst any elite group in Sweden.
Interesting.
So what's interesting is the Swedish example seems to say you can change inequality, but it's much harder to actually change social mobility. And social mobility seems almost impossible for societies to change much. And so another example is we can, again, using surnames, we can measure social mobility in medieval England. And the answer is that there was as much social mobility in feudal England as there is in modern America. That we haven't been able to change that fundamental feature of societies. And so the good news of the study is that in the end, everyone's great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren are predicted on average to be equal. The bad news is that we can find some cases where that process is taking 500 to 600 years to go through.
We welcome phone calls for our guest, Professor Gregory Clark, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Davis, the author of A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. Our conversation begun because of this study that was done by the Pew Research Center showing Americans are earning more than their parents did, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're moving up the economic ladder. And our guest has, as you can tell, not only personally a history of having lived in various parts of the world and seeing some dramatic changes in his family going back generations, but also looking at different economic structures in the world and what it does to social mobility. Here's our phone number. Join us. We'd love to have you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Social mobility this hour of the program with Professor Gregory Clark, Professor of Economics at UC Davis, whose main research area is long-run economic growth, the wealth of nations, with a particular focus on the economic history of England and India. He teaches world economic history. And we're talking about the Pew Research Center's study on social mobility, which looks at how children are faring economically and in terms of social mobility compared to their parents. Matt is our first caller from Menominee. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Kathleen. I was going to say that I was going to go back to the professor's thing on kind of like a legacy. I want to comment first about, you know, cost of living standards and just how much more money it costs, and, you know, for utilities, gasoline, all those things. But when he's starting to talk about just, you know, basically like mobility and how their kids are just more likely to succeed based on what their parents and stuff. And I just thought that it's really interesting. My great grandfather immigrated from Sweden, actually, was a poor farmer. He's 16 years old. The farm got sold. He came and started his own life here in Wisconsin and built up for himself a great reputation. And he's got grandchildren, or my aunts, that are college professors, engineers, and these different things. Because I don't believe because it's something they were given, but it's something that they earned and they worked hard for. And I think that leads to a lot of social mobility. And I also believe that people with college educations can have great jobs. It's not, I work beside guys that make a lot more money than I do, even though I'm college educated, because they did it because of hard work. So I don't think social mobility is dead in America. But thanks.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Gregory.
When you look at families, they exhibit all kinds of patterns and all kinds of paths. But it's only when we look at the aggregate data that you can see that there really is this surprising persistence, and that it's strong. There's lots of noise. There's lots of individual variation. Brothers differ from brothers. But the interesting feature that we find is that the upper middle class families are tending to persist in that strata over many generations, and that we can predict a lot. We can predict probably 60 or 70% of the variation in outcomes in terms of social status for people at the time of their birth. And that still leaves a fair amount that's not predicted, but it does mean that, whatever people's individual stories are, there's a surprisingly strong structure that's underlying this. And I am actually not, some people regard high level of social mobility as the prerequisite of a good society. I don't think that that's necessarily the case, but I think that we do have to see and recognize in the data that a lot of stuff about people's outcomes is actually highly predictable at the time they're conceived.
So have you been able to look at, again, looking at comparisons of income? We're talking on a day when the Dow Jones in America is at a record high, and we've seen news reports this week, again, about the growing gap between those who are way up there as far as social mobility. They're way at the top, and all the rest of the people. When you talk about a good society, can we look at whether or not we're in a good society with the state of the economy right now, or are societies where there is not this gap, are they deemed better societies? I mean, can you look at that?
Well, I think the one justification that people have in America for committing enormous inequalities in wealth and income and education is the idea that we live in a high mobility society, that anyone with the right energy or enthusiasm could attain any of the positions in the society. I think once people see this information on what the true rates of social mobility are, they have to then step back and think, well, if there really is so little social mobility in between any generations, does that influence what I'm going to think about how much inequality you want in the society? And I think people have, or modern studies in America have conveyed the impression that there's much more social mobility than there really is. And if we recognize that it's limited social mobility, then, for someone like me, it does say we should think about how much inequality you really want to persist in this society, because it's not the case that many families are going to go from rags to riches in one generation. And, in fact, the data that I have shows that that outcome is very, very rare in all societies.
Hmm. And do you, in order to have an upper class that is extremely wealthy, do you have to have the kind of disparity that we have in this country, or is there much room for people to share in the riches?
Well, we have examples of societies like Sweden or Denmark or Norway where there is much more sharing of the riches of the society, and these are actually quite functional economies. They produce levels of output per person, per hour that people work, that are quite comparable with the United States. And so what that people should recognize is there are various possible ways of arranging society. They're not going to cause the collapse of economies. And in deciding which of those outcomes you want, one of the things that I think people would want to know is, well, what are the possibilities for everyone in society at the point of your birth? How much of your outcome is actually determined at that point?
Let's go to June, our next caller in Milwaukee. Hi, June.
Hi. Thank you for this wonderful discussion. I have a question for the professor. I was fortunate enough to spend some time in India a few years ago, And I remember going to a conference with some of the women of the Chamber of Commerce and some people who were owners of some of the major developments in New Delhi. We heard their lectures, and then I remember that we had seen some of these incredible structures, and they would be right across the street from unbelievable slums. And where the large buildings had been built had previously been the same kind of slums as we were seeing across the street. So my question to the meeting was that in the United States, after probably maybe the beginning of the last century, we began to realize that, you know, if you have a huge wealthy apartment building and you're going to have slums next door, it's not a good thing. So they started to create charities that would take care of the poor people, and they started to eventually, I think after the 1950s, have rules where if you built X, you would have to provide, let's say, 10 or 15% of low-income housing at the same time that you were building the higher-income housing. So I asked if that was happening in India, and the person who was speaking was he understood. He was very apologetic. He said, we're not quite there yet. So my question for you is, are they there yet? Are they doing this? Are there changes?
In this book that I'm working on, it actually is comparing social mobility in communist China, Sweden, Chile, United States, England, Japan, and also India. And what I can report is that India shows up as the society with the lowest rate of measured social mobility anywhere in the world. And the evidence from India is that you really do get people trapped in various different strata of the society. And in particular, I look at West Bengal, and the Brahmin class in West Bengal is very persistent as an upper group in that society. And now a lot of the lower group is actually the Muslim population in West Bengal, and they've actually shown since independence for a long period negative social mobility. That is, they were actually getting, even though they were poor already, they were getting poorer. And so I can actually say that India faces the greatest challenges of anywhere in terms of social mobility. But what's interesting is that the conclusion of the book is going to be that what drives that in a society like India is the very low rate of intermarriage between different groups within the society.
Mm-hmm.
That the fundamental thing that actually drives social mobility is not government provision of housing projects or welfare institutions, stuff like that. That mobility comes from families themselves, and that societies which are very open and where there's a lot of intermarriage between different social groups are ones that achieve higher rates of social mobility, and that India's problem is actually the fact that still people are very much tending to marry within caste groups or within religious groups, and that that's actually why it's not the institutions, it's the patterns of marriage in India that are making it very hard for poorer groups to move up.
Anything else, Thanks. June?
Pardon?
Anything else?
Yes, I had just a comment to add to that. First of all, thank you so much for the answer. I was thinking that if they had better housing that would include things like schools, and part of the things we were there with was a charity called Children's Hope India that does provide schooling and, you know, food and everything they need for street children and their families. It occurred to me that if they had equal education so that you could have someone, let's say, who would become an attorney and then work in an attorney firm with someone else who was of a, let's say, a higher class or caste status in India, then there could be intermarriage. But you're not going to get that kind of intermarriage unless and until you have good housing, good education for everyone. You know, don't you agree that in that sense the institution is also important?
One of the very interesting features of this study was that we could look in some societies like Sweden or Britain at the period when the government did nothing for the poor. And essentially, you were on your own in terms of education, and it was a free market economy in that sense. And then we see, as we move to places like Sweden now, that education, university education, is free. There are substantial government loans and grants to students. you've got a society which just has a very different basis of provision of health and education. And what's surprising is that it hasn't managed to change the rate of social mobility in Sweden, that it is no higher now than it was in the 19th century. And similarly in Britain, the arrival of the welfare state, it amazingly has not had any influence on rates of social mobility compared to the medieval period. And so that's how to say why this study is saying that it's actually very hard to find evidence that social policies really can change, as surprising as it may seem, can change that rate of social mobility. And what's interesting, in India actually has very radical policies in employment in government and in admission to universities, where 50% of all the places in the universities and in government are reserved for people who are either from the former untouchable castes or are from backward castes, as it's called. And you would think that that would be a huge impetus to social mobility. But it turns out that only a very small group of people are able to benefit from those reservations, and those are people who anyway were middle class before the reservations were instituted and just happened to be misclassified as falling within this poor group. And what you can see is that that policy just hasn't helped the very poorest, because they never even get close to getting into the government jobs or applying to the university. And so, as one of, you know, it's not, the book is not finalized yet, but one of the surprising outcomes has been to see how little it's possible to change rates of social mobility by the type of government policies that we observe and practice.
Thank you, June, very much for your call. Our number, lines are open for you, 800-486-8655. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. I think the situation as far as economic status over the last 60 years has been like a children's slide downward, and it seemed to me like trying to crawl that or get up that slide from the bottom, because my parents were able to put me through private grade school, a private boys' school away from home, a private college away from home. For 16 years of private school, and it was only through the GI Bill that I was able to go to earn a professional degree. But even with the professional degree, I was working more than 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, and my wife was working, and I was not able to pay for a school for my children, to cover their total expenses like my parents were. So it's been a downward slide.
Well, this is an interesting feature of social mobility, which is that, and it's something that anyone who, you know, like myself, has a good job and secure employment has to face, is that if you're above average, as it sounds like your parents were, it tends to be that your kids move towards the mean, right? And, you know, social mobility, everyone who's moving up the ladder, someone else is coming down the ladder as well. And so it looks very different from the point of view of the top 10 or 20% of the population. Social mobility seems like, where's the economic opportunity that used to exist for their parents? Why are things tougher? And so, as I say, there are going to be lots of people in any society who look back at their parents and say life was better for them, easier for them, and it's more of a struggle for me. And it's just the nature of social mobility that it has to be that way. So in the book, I mean, you talk all of it about, there is this pool of the average on the mean, and that's where families in the long run are going to be tending to head and they're just thrown away from that by various random factors. But it's going to seem, you know, as I say, if we look at individual family histories, you'll see a lot of people who see that, hey, my grandparents were doing relatively much better than I'm doing. And all I can say is it just turns out to be the law of society.
And they were doing much better because their jobs paid more or the economy was different in the country, or why were they doing much better?
Oh, simply because there's, you know, at any time, there's people who are successful and lucky and, you know, have good fortune. And when that happens, it's always going to be the case that when, not always, but on average, when their children look back, they'll say, hold on, how come those guys were doing so well? Life is more of a struggle now for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the nature of the process, right? Mm-hmm. That there's that any upward social mobility is going to be balanced by equivalent downward social mobility.
Right. So social mobility is what we're talking about this hour, our conversation prompted by the Pew Research Center's release of a study on social mobility in this country. Gregory Clark goes beyond the country with his writings and with his special research. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, is the author of A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. He is from Scotland, grew up in Scotland, where he studied, and then he came to the sunshine of Northern California after he was on the East Coast of this country studying. And so he's with us now to talk about this very interesting topic. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, the man who's been called the minimalist president, Calvin Coolidge, will speak with the author of a substantial biography of our 30th president. All right, back to phone calls. Lou in Madison is next. Hi, Lou.
Oh, hi. I think it's really interesting program, and I think it's fascinating how you can hear in the voice of some of the callers they don't want to accept this data. My question is, did your study at all look at adoption? Coming from, let's say, you know, the Ozarks in Missouri, being adopted into a more affluent and upwardly mobile family, or a family in a higher economic strata, is that birth effect then pretty much wiped out, or didn't you look at that?
Well, the last part, one of the things that you have to struggle with in the book is, what is it that's driving this persistence so powerfully within families? I mean, why can't the rich, you know, living in Manhattan, ensure that their children achieve the same status as they did? And why can't poor parents get their kids all the way up the social ladder? And it turns out there are some very interesting adoption studies that are actually going to be quoted in the book. And one of the nicest of these is one by a guy called Bruce Sacerdote, who's from Dartmouth College. And he had a great set of data on adoption of Korean orphans by American families after the Korean War, where these children were randomly placed in families that actually varied quite a lot in terms of their incomes, their mother's education. And the stunning outcome of that study was, if you looked at, for example, the income of the children, the Korean children, they were placed in families where income varied in modern terms from the equivalent of $20,000 a year to $200,000 a year. It had no effect on the income of the adopted children. The ones in the families with the lowest income earned as much in their own lives as the ones in the families with the highest income. And simply being placed in a high-income family, it couldn't change the outcomes. For education, there were some effects. And so if you were placed with a mother who hadn't completed high school, it did affect the chances that you would complete high school for the adoptees. But once you got to families where the mother had at least some college education and beyond, again, it had absolutely no effect on the outcomes for the children. And so I think the adoption studies, there have been other adoption studies, they do suggest that adopted parents can have some influence on the outcomes for their children, But they also suggest that the genetics of the children are the most important factor in terms of what their social success is going to be. And that says that at least one very important path in determining outcomes for families is actually it's the genetics that the parents are handing on to the kids. Right? It's not everything, but it's very important, you know, for these studies of adoption. And it's going to be more important the further up you are in the social scale, right? That is, the difference between the very kind of fanciest families with the highest levels of education and kind of the people at the average, their differences in rearing don't seem to make much difference. If you go to the very bottom of the social scale, there we think that the environment can actually matter much more. But as I say, the surprising outcome of these adoption studies, and there have also been ones done in Sweden where they have very good data, one of the stunning things they suggest is that one of the reasons we can predict your outcomes when you're born is because at that point your genetic makeup has been determined, and that's actually going to be very important in your economic success.
Oh, that's fascinating and very surprising. George in Columbus, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and Dr. Clark. My question is, what can be done to improve social mobility?
I'm afraid well, the conclusion of the book is going to be we just do not see many examples of societies that have managed to improve the rate of social mobility. Right? If Sweden can't change the rate of social mobility, then there's no hope that America can do it because of the very different level of interventions that we have in family life in Sweden. And that America is never going to tolerate the kind of level of intervention that they have in a society like Sweden. And so that's why the conclusion of the book is going to be it's much better just to think about inequality and reducing inequality of outcomes than trying to speed up the rate of social mobility. And what you do see in a society like Sweden is that you can reduce the penalty that poor people pay in terms of how many years of life they're going to live compared to rich people quite substantially by the appropriate social institutions. And that's actually an area where we know we can actually produce some results. But the surprising feature of this study is that it says that in terms of actually pushing people up from the bottom, up into the middle of the distribution, we just don't observe societies that have managed to change that process. And that even in Sweden, with all the opportunities of education, healthcare, etc., what's happening inside families is still the most powerful determinant of what the chances are of those children. And it's stuff that we just can't change, right? We might be able to change it if we took those kids away and put them into very different families, but even there, the adoption studies suggest that those results would actually be quite modest.
Thank you, George, very much for your call. Mike is next, and Mike is in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My question relates to Head Start, which is in the news these days. There's some research Nicholas Kristof cited recently that kids who go to Head Start graduate at a much higher rate. And there's other research that challenges that. I wonder if Head Start has an impact on success or mobility in children.
That's an area where there's a lot of debate and a lot of controversy. A study recently, a very good controlled study, which looked at kids who were beneficiaries of Head Start randomly and those who were randomly not given the benefits, found that by third grade, there was no measurable difference between those two groups of kids. There was an initial benefit while they were in Head Start, but that by third grade, that had disappeared. But as I say, there are these other studies out that do suggest benefits, and all we can say is that it's a matter of considerable contention, right? Because if you can't see any difference by the time they're in third grade, the question is then, why would you expect as adults to see differences? But it has to be said that James Heckman, who's a very, very fine econometrician from the University of Chicago, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics,
yeah.
believes very strongly that high-quality early interventions can be shown to make a difference to the lives of children, right? But the only thing
I wonder if the fact that parents maybe are more engaged because of Head Start. I know the academics may dissipate, but perhaps parents become more involved in education. I don't know.
Question. Right, no, and it is. But the only thing I would say about the studies that Heckman refers to and points to as showing that you really can make a difference is that this is looking at the families that are in the bottom 1%, 2%, or 3% of American society. And it may be that for people at that level, interventions can work. All I'm saying is that if you look at the bulk of the society, right, the people who are in the top 80% of the society, they're the idea that public interventions, supply of better quality schools, better quality kindergarten, stuff like that, the idea that that can actually change the outcomes, there's very little evidence. And, for example, Sweden has a very good quality supply of kindergarten and preschool education to families at very low cost, and much better than in the United States. But as I say, we don't see any improvement in rates of social mobility. And so I absolutely agree with you pointing out that there is interesting evidence about the possibilities of Head Start and these other programs. It's still not settled, though. And it may be that these interventions can really only help the children who are at the very bottom end. Though, of course, we would want to do that if we could achieve it.
Thanks very much for the call. Have you studied at all families who've lost everything, really rich families, very upper 1%, 10%, who maybe lost it all during a depression?
Well, that is an interesting question because it puts in mind that I should go back and try and look at things like that, because there are other families who have a kind of big shock to wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Because my impression is that these families, they tend to do well in all aspects of life. So you could take away their wealth from them, but it's still going to be the case that those families will have high levels of education, will succeed well in professions, will do well in other areas of life. And so I would think if we could find a nice controlled study where we had a group of people who did have this shock, and in some sense you think about the Jewish community in Israel, in the United States, a lot of those people went through exactly
yes.
dispossession.
Right.
And the evidence is, as I say, that that is not going to result in large-scale downward social mobility, that those families will actually do very well. In their circumstances, even once they've had this shock to their professions and to their wealth. And again, Jewish emigres from Russia, often came to the United States with almost nothing, but you'll find that those are people who actually succeed quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, one yes. of the things we find in the study is that there are surprising and kind of unexpected kind of elite and kind of underclass groups within the United States just based on surnames. And so one odd feature is that French Canadians in the United States are a very distinct underclass and will show up amongst high status professions at much lower rate than you would expect for that group, even though I don't think most people even would think of them
right.
as a minority
no.
group within the United States. And another odd feature is that Coptic Egyptians, that is the traditional Christians of Egypt, in the United States are one of the most elite groups of immigrants into the United States.
Oh, that's fascinating. We are plumb out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Gregory
sure,
Clark. Thanks. Professor Gregory Clark, social mobility, our topic this hour, the Pew Research Study. You may want to look that up to get more information about what it showed, that Americans making more money than their parents, but it doesn't mean that they're more socially Mobile. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour and Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We're with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And at 10 tomorrow, we're going to learn a great deal about a man we probably don't know as much as we should know, Calvin Coolidge. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.